Brother Justin, Geek from My Youth. In this episode, I'd like to share with you a talk that I gave at Simon Fraser University at the invitation of a dear friend and partner of mine, Dr. Ken Signori, who teaches world literature there. The course that he was teaching was a course on biblical intertextuality in world literature, and he invited me to give a talk on biblical echoes in fantasy and science fiction, which I chose to do by focusing on three excerpts from J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, and science fiction author John Wyndham. It was interesting returning to talking about literature in an academic setting after so many years. I did most of my master's degree in English literature at UBC prior to embarking on my master's degree at St. Vladimir's Seminary when I decided to become a priest. And my major mentor there, Dr. Lee M. Johnson, was a formalist. And I realized that as I was engaging in sort of this back and forth dialogue, discussing how I was going to present and what I was going to present with Ken, I realized I'm a formalist myself. At least that seems to be the focus here in this talk. I enjoy looking at various forms, in this case, forms of intertextuality, and how they work and how they accomplish what they do in literature. So that was the focus of this talk. I should make one note about the audio quality. I unfortunately hooked up this mic to my cross. So after recording the talk, I had two choices. Either take the talk from the video feed, somebody videotaped the talk, which was okay, but from a bit of a distance away, or take the talk from the audio that I'd recorded and just put up with all the little minor clicking noises whenever I get really excited, start gesticulating, and the mic knocks against my cross. So I chose that as the lesser of the two evils, or at least this way you can choose whether you go and watch the video, I'll put a link to it in the description, or whether you listen to it here on the podcast. So without further ado, here is my talk on biblical echoes in science fiction and fantasy in the works of Tolkien, Lewis, and John Wyndham.
Thank you, Ken. I am honored and delighted to be here, and I want to invite you to join me in an adventure that will go through space and time and other worlds as we look at biblical echoes in fantasy and science fiction in the works of Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, and John Wyndham. When I talk about biblical echoes here, I'm not talking about listening for Bible verses echoing through the halls of Khazad-dûm, or echoing through the handrimits of Malakandra, but rather what we're talking about here is intertextuality. Intertextuality is, of course, a technical word which really, I think, describes the nature of language itself. Language is inherently intertextual, since the mutual understanding that is necessary for language is rooted and grounded in our shared human experience, which is best preserved in text, and at its most universal, and therefore most communicatively grounding in the shared experience of culture, history, and myth. And to give an illustration of this, I want to share with you an exchange I had with somebody from a different culture, from Lebanon. Ken knows her very well. And she was telling me about her friend and how she was at her friend's place with a whole bunch of other friends, and they were talking late into the night, and her friend would make the comment in this situation, what is this, St. Kyriakos night? Now, for you and I, who didn't grow up in Lebanon, it's like, okay, well, what does that mean? We're not rooted and grounded in this culture, right? For somebody from Lebanon, at the very base, they would know that St. Kyriakos, well, he's a holy man, obviously. We could probably pick that much up. But they would also know that on the eve of his feast day, they would spend the whole night feasting and celebrating and partying in preparation for the day itself. And she herself mentioned this to me when I had done a little bit of a message on St. Kyriakos, or mentioned to him in one of my homilies. I happened to mention that St. Kyriakos' rule was actually to fast during the day. So, which would explain why. So there's, first of all, for those of us who aren't part of this culture, we don't get it. That's kind of important, right? But the more that you get, the more this simple short phrase resonates with us. And that is the same for all of language. Now, nobody knew this better than the professional philologist and father of modern fantasy, J.R.R. Tolkien, who spent most of his adult life composing a mythological history of Middle-earth as a backdrop for his invented languages. He really just wanted to invent languages. He wanted a language that sounded nice, and so he invented Elvish, actually a whole bunch of different dialects of Elvish. But he knew that that language is rooted and grounded in history and myth and culture. And so he had to invent an entire world as the backdrop of this language, as the source material upon which this language was drawing. And few, I think, have realized the philosophical significance of this as deeply as Tolkien's friend and fellow fantasist, C.S. Lewis. The beginnings of this realization seem to have been rooted and grounded in a conversation that Lewis and Tolkien had that led to Lewis writing his science fiction classic, Out of the Silent Planet. "Tollers," said Lewis to Tolkien, "there's too little of what we really like in stories. I'm afraid we shall have to write some ourselves." And they agreed that they would try, that Lewis would write something about space travel and Tolkien would try something about time travel. His result, says Tolkien, is well known. "My effort, after a few promising chapters, ran dry. It was too long a way around to what I really wanted to make, a new version of the Atlantis legend. The final scene survives in The Downfall of Numenor." If you're a Tolkien fan, you'll know that's in the Silmarillion. Out of the Silent Planet, C.S. Lewis's science fiction work, debuted to mixed reviews, often being compared unfavorably to H.G. Wells, which I think Lewis, as a great fan of H.G. Wells, he particularly loved The First Men in the Moon, would have actually taken as a compliment. But what surprised Lewis most about the 60 reviews that his book garnered, which is actually quite a few for a first-time author, was that out of all that 60, only two showed any awareness of the book's Christian theology, which led Lewis, as a Christian, to write, "If only there was someone with a richer talent and more leisure than him, maybe more leisure, I think this great ignorance might be a help to the evangelization of England. Any amount of theology can now be smuggled in to people's minds under cover of romance without their knowing it." And Lewis knew this phenomenon firsthand. In his spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy, he describes exactly this effect happening when, upon his first stumbling upon George MacDonald's fantasy novel, Phantasties, where he says, "The woodland journeyings in that story, the ghostly enemies, the ladies, both good and evil, were close enough to my habitual imagery to lure me on without perception of a change. As if I was carried sleeping across the frontier. For now I perceived that while the air of the new region made all my erotic and magical perversions of joy look like sordid trumpery, it had no such disenchanting power over the bread upon the table or the coals in the grate. That was the marvel. Up till now, each visitation of joy," and in this spiritual autobiography, Lewis describes joy as that which was what he was hankering after, yearning for. And he'd had experience of it, particularly in literature. "But up till now, each visitation of joy had left the common world momentarily a desert. But now I saw the bright shadow coming out of the book into the real world and resting there, transforming all common things and yet itself unchanged. Or more accurately, I saw the common things drawn into the bright shadow. That night," he says, "my imagination was, in a certain sense, baptized. The rest of me, not unnaturally, took longer." Of course, within the Christian tradition, baptism is the initiation into the Christian faith. It is also understood as illumination. You are seeing the world as it really is for the first time. And Tolkien related the intended goal of both his and Lewis's work in, or then amateur efforts, because they were both relatively unpublished at the time, as, "We originally meant each to write an excursionary thriller, a space journey and a time journey, that would end up with each discovering myth." And for Lewis and Tolkien, myth does not mean something false or not unreal, but something that is at its most basic, that gets at the essence of what is ultimately real. So this ultimate encounter with myth was, of course, for Lewis and Tolkien as Christians, inherently biblically intertextual. And I want to talk about two works from them, plus one of my favorite passages from probably my favorite post-apocalyptic sci-fi novel, John Wyndham's Day of the Trippet. But before we dive into these works, I want to make a hopefully helpful distinction between two different forms, one might almost say levels of intertextuality. On the base form, the base level of intertextuality, we would have reference. When you refer to something, and that could be a direct reference, like an allusion, or it could be something that simply draws a vivid parallel, a parallel that you just can't mistake, which would be, I guess, supposedly something like a metaphor, right? An unstated comparison. But there's another level that occurs particularly in fantasy and science fiction, which we'll get into a little later on, which is, I would say, recontextualization. And that really takes place within the world-building activities of fantasy and science fiction. So we'll save that for later. Let's start, first of all, with John Wyndham's Day of the Trippet, where we have a very clear reference, a very clear biblically intertextual reference to the flood. But I have to set the scene here, because one of the things that I've done, as I've suggested, hey, maybe you could read these ahead of time, I've had to take some excerpts. And one of the sad things about taking excerpts like this is that you miss most of the world building, which is the whole point of fantasy and science fiction, or at least the whole undergirding reality behind the effect, the power of fantasy and science fiction. So let me just set the scene here. In John Wyndham's The Day of the Trippets, man has created a biologically engineered, semi-sentient, mobile plant called the Trippet. The Trippet is being harvested and farmed by human beings for its oils. But in order to get the best oils out of the Trippet, you have to leave this big stalk that's kind of on the top of it unclipped. Because if you clip it, the oils just aren't as good. The problem with the stalk is you can actually get killed by the Trippet. But of course, you know, Trippets being ambling semi-sentient plants aren't terribly dangerous. What changes everything is that the world experiences this amazing comet shower, something like the Perseids, only much more spectacular. And the sky is filled with showering comets comet debris and flashes of green light, and it's absolutely spectacular. And everybody is aware that this is happening, and they're all up looking at the heavens. And the very next day, everybody who has watched this amazing display wakes up blind. All of a sudden, the main advantage that we have over the Trippets, sight, is gone. And the world, I mean, what would already be an apocalyptic nightmare, the world collapsing as everybody wakes up blind, becomes something even more deadly and dangerous, a true apocalypse, as the Trippets that people have been farming for oil break out and start killing all of the people who are blind. So this is a classic post-apocalyptic survival story, and what I'm jumping in here is actually right near the end, where the two main characters, Bill and Josella, have set up a little kind of farm kind of community where they are trying to raise a family and look after some of the blind people and protect them from the Trippets. And being sighted, it's not too hard for them, but the Trippets keep multiplying and keep encroaching. And of course, society is absolutely destroyed. So think any apocalyptic sci-fi fiction novel or film, and you get the scene. So Josella frowns down on a group of four Trippets ambling across the field. "If I were a child now," she said reflectively, "I think I would want a reason for what happened. Unless I was given it, that is, if I were allowed to think that I had been born into a world that had been quite pointlessly destroyed, I should find living quite pointless too. That does make it awfully difficult, because it seems to be just what has happened. She paused, pondering, and then added, do you think we should be justified in starting a myth to help them? A story of a world that was wonderfully clever, but so wicked that it had to be destroyed, or destroyed itself by accident. Something like the flood, again. That wouldn't crush them with inferiority. It could give the incentive to build, and this time to build something better.
Yes, says Bill, considering it. Yes, it's often a good idea to tell children the truth. Kind of makes things easier for them later on. Only why pretend it's a myth?
I'm going to stop and set that one aside for now. We'll come back to it later. But here we have, as I say, the base level of biblical intertextuality. It's a very clear reference to the flood. Everybody knows the story. Noah builds the ark, and God sends a flood upon the world, and it's destroyed. This is interesting for a couple of different reasons. Like the way that this works, obviously, on the one hand, it is a post-apocalyptic nightmare, but it's also one where they want to have some sort of reason for what has happened, some sort of meaning behind what has happened. We find it, as human beings, strangely difficult to live in a world that's actually meaningless. Oddly, we actually act as though our actions and our words actually mean something. And so she's suggesting maybe what we need to do is invent a myth, something like the flood. This actually also gets at kind of the reason why science fiction is being written. And I'm going to return to that in a minute as we go to the next level of intertextuality in just a moment. But I'm going to pause there and shift over to Khazad-dûm. This one you probably all know. You've seen the movie or read the book. Even though this is an excerpt, you probably know exactly where it fits. Even if you haven't, you've probably seen the memes, right? Where you've got Gandalf facing down the Balrog or whatever other big thing that you want him to face down, saying, "You shall not pass." Tolkien actually does it a bit better, I think. Gandalf, of course, is fighting a rearguard action here against this evil creature of fire and shadow, the Balrog. And he tells everybody to go over the bridge, and he is at the back. He says, "Fly, this is a foe beyond any of you. I must hold the narrow way. Fly." And they fly over the bridge, well, run over the bridge, and stop waiting. The Balrog reaches the bridge. Gandalf stood in the middle of the span, leaning on his staff. And in the other hand, Glamdring, his sword gleams, cold and white. His enemy halted again, facing him, and the shadow about it reached out like two vast wings. It raised the whip, and the thongs whined and cracked. Fire came from its nostrils, but Gandalf stood firm. "You cannot pass," he said. The orc stood still, and a dead silence fell. "I am a servant of the secret fire, wielder of the flame of Arnor. You cannot pass. The dark fire will not avail you, flame of Udun. Go back to the shadow. You cannot pass." The Balrog made no answer. The fire in it seemed to die, but the darkness grew. It stepped forward slowly onto the bridge. Suddenly it drew itself up to a great height, and wings were spread from wall to wall, but Gandalf could be seen glimmering in the gloom. He seemed small and altogether alone, gray and bent, like a wizened tree before the onset of a storm. At that moment, Gandalf lifted his staff, and crying aloud, he smote the bridge before him. A blinding sheet of white flame sprang up. The bridge cracked. Right at the Balrog's feet, it broke, and the stone upon which it stood crashed into the gulf while the rest remained, poised, quivering like a tongue of rock thrust out into emptiness. With a terrible cry, the Balrog fell forward, and its shadow plunged down and vanished. But even as it fell, it swung its whip, and the thorns lashed and curled about the wizard's knees, dragging him to the brink. He staggered and fell, grasped vainly at the stone, and slid into the abyss. "Fly, you fools," he cried, and was gone. And that, of course, is the end of Gandalf in the Fellowship of the Ring. He returns. That's the key here, because, of course, that's not the end of the story. But as he returns, he relates his fight with the Balrog, which, of course, is the opening scene of the Two Towers. "Long I fell, and he fell with me. His fire was about me. I was burned. Then we plunged into deep water, and all was dark." So he falls all the way down to the very roots of the mountain, plunges into the water, they fight, They continue the fight all the way up the stairs, all the way to the heights of the mountain. And what does he say would see? What would they say in song? Those that looked up from afar must have thought that the mountain was crowned with storm. Thunder they heard, and lightning, they said, smote upon Kalebdil, the name of the mountain, and leaped back into broken tongues of fire. A great smoke arose about us. Ice fell like rain. I threw down my enemy, and he fell from the high place and broke the mountainside where he smote it in his ruin. Then darkness took me, and I strayed out of thought and time, and I wandered far on roads that I will not tell. Naked I was sent back for a brief time until my task is done. So, obviously, it's a very dramatic confrontation, but for anybody with any background in any of the Christian Western tradition, this descent into the depths, fighting evil, and rising to the heights, and triumphing over evil in death, resonates with the image of Gandalf as a Christ figure, or makes the image of Gandalf the image of somebody who is like Christ, the Messiah. And so this is not stated, as is probably the case, not unexpected with Tolkien. It's implied, right? Not stated. But because this story, this mythical or deeply true story, is deeply embedded in the mythic imagination of our society, it has this extra layer of resonance. Interestingly, this resonance works two ways. On the one hand, it gives Gandalf and his fight with the Balrog a new layer of significance. It is like the attack, the fight which saved the world. And it's where Christ saves the world by fighting evil and dies in the process, and then is brought back to life and brought back into this world. It also has an effect on anybody remembering this, because one of the things about this particular very important moment in the Christian understanding is that it gets papered over with an awful lot of theological reflection. So much so that you often forget this is the ultimate showdown, the ultimate fight between good and evil. And this brings out in a kind of visceral, historic way that fight, that struggle. So this is the effect of this kind of intertextuality. Not only does it provide an extra layer of depth to the literature that is drawing on this whatever myth or history or legend or however you want to see it, this extra layer of text, it brings that into the text itself, but it also works the other way and helps us to reflect in new ways on that original text. So let's bring it up to the next level. The way that science fiction and fantasy especially work with this this kind of biblical intertextuality is what I would characterize as recontextualization. And it works this way especially through something that is fairly unique to the genres of fantasy and science fiction, through world building. Because this begins with this reference. It could be a direct reference or an indirect reference, a parallel. But it then brings it into a new context. And we see this right here, as we've just said, with Gandalf and the Balrog, right? On the one hand, we have an obvious reference which gives an extra layer of resonance, but by recontextualizing it, we think about both elements in a new way. And in particular, we think about the element that is being referred to in a new way. So one, I kind of like to think about it in the in the context of the old Kellogg's cornflake commercial. You're probably too young to, most of you are probably too young to remember it, but the Kellogg's cornflakes commercial was, the line was, taste them again for the first time. So, and this the way that this works, this recontextualization works, it allows us to take something that we know already and then to taste it again for the first time, to refamiliarize ourselves with it. But it would be, what that process actually begins with is not so much refamiliarization as defamiliarization. Because this is the other way in which this recontextualization works, is that there are all sorts of things that we kind of just automatically dismiss. We've made up our minds. There's been all sorts of studies, actually, on how human beings are really resistant to changing our minds about something. Like, we have this concept in our minds, and then we have something that challenges that concept, and we tend to dismiss it, or not think about it, or not want to think about it. But what science fiction and fantasy do is it takes those things that we think we know already, and when there's this intertextuality at work, it defamiliarizes it, so that the effect is to once again make room for something that we may have previously dismissed, helping us to reconsider a case which we may have once considered closed. And here I want to begin by returning to John Wyndham's Day of the Triffids. So once Bill says, yes, it's often a good idea to tell children the truth, kind of makes things easier for them later on, only why pretend it's a myth? Gisela is kind of surprised at this. How do you mean? You know, the Triffids, well, they were somebody's fault, or mistake, I admit, but the rest, it wasn't our fault the conditions changed. It was just one of those things, like earthquakes or hurricanes, what an insurance company would call an act of God. Maybe that's just what it was, a judgment. Certainly we never brought that comet, didn't we, Gisela? Are you quite sure of that? She turned to look at me. Are you trying to tell me you don't think it was a comet at all? Just exactly that, I agreed. Up there, I went on. This pulled from Bill's perspective. Up there, there were, and maybe still are, unknown numbers of satellite weapons circling round and round the Earth. Just a lot of dormant menaces, touring around, waiting for someone, something to set them off. What was in them? You don't know. I don't know. Top secret stuff. All we've heard is guesses. Fissile materials, radioactive dust, bacteria, viruses. Now suppose that one type happened to have been constructed especially to emit radiations that our eyes would not stand, something that would burn out or at least damage the optic nerve. Gisela gripped my hand. Oh no, Bill. No, they couldn't. That'd be diabolical. Oh, I can't believe. Oh no, Bill. Interesting reference here. Diabolical, right? My sweet, all the things up there were diabolical. Do you doubt that it could be done? That if it could be done, someone would do it? Then suppose it were a mistake, or perhaps an accident, maybe such an accident as actually encountering a shower of comet debris, if you like, which starts some of those things popping. Well, naturally, those things were intended to operate close to the ground, where the effect would be spread out over a definitely calculable area, but they start going off out there in space, or maybe when they hit the atmosphere. Either way, they're operating so far up that people all around the world would receive direct radiations from them. Just what did happen is anyone's guess. But one thing I'm quite certain of, that somehow or other we brought this lot down on ourselves. Well, when you put it that way, murmured Gisela. She broke off and was lost in silence for quite a while. Then she said, I suppose in a way that should be more horrible than the idea of nature striking blindly at us. And yet, I don't think it is. It makes me feel less hopeless about things because it makes them at least comprehensible. If it was like that, then it is at least a thing that can be prevented from happening again. Just one more of the mistakes our very great grandchildren are going to have to avoid. And oh dear, there were so many, many mistakes. But we can warn them. What's going on here, I would suggest, with the Day of the Triffids, this is kind of the point of the Day of the Triffids, right? Is another form of what I would consider biblical intertextuality. This is prophecy. What is a prophet? Within the Christian tradition, a prophet is somebody who speaks the truth from the ultimate context of reality. In the Christian tradition, that is, of course, God. Within science fiction, the general ultimate form of reality is scientific materialism and the world as it is. So somebody speaking from that perspective in an authoritative way to warn is essentially a prophet. And I would suggest that that is what all, well, maybe not all, but a good chunk of the best of 1950s and 1960s science fiction is, and why everybody should have read it prior to the last, well, few great crises that we've just encountered, because it's all back to, anyhow, I won't go there. Finally, I want to finish with C.S. Lewis, my hero and mentor, and the climactic chapter of his first science fiction novel, Out of the Silent Planet. The silent planet in the eponymous novel is Earth. It is silent because it is a planet that is under siege. It is disconnected from the heavens. And the hero, Ransom, is kidnapped by Dr. Weston and Divine and taken to a planet he doesn't know what it is at first. It turns out to be Mars, otherwise known as Malacandra. It's all a misunderstanding. Weston and Divine have been told that they need to bring somebody else from Earth. And they think that they assume that it's some sort of sacrifice. So they're kidnapping Ransom to be a sacrifice. Interestingly, he was originally named Unwin. Same name as Stanley Unwin, Tolkien's publisher, and Lewis changed it and gave Ransom to him as a pseudonym because he is the Ransom. It turns out to be all a misunderstanding. Mars is essentially an unfallen world. It's a world that's been touched by the fall of our world, by the destruction, the distortion, the evil that is part of the planet Earth. But it is largely unfallen. And so they have no words for anything that we would consider evil in our world. The closest that you can come in the Malacandrian language, the language of Mars, to anything evil is the word bent. Because evil is really just bent good. And Ransom ultimately is taken to the Oyarsa of Mars. And here, again, we're skipping so much of the world building. I'm giving you all these terms. But if you read the book, go read the book. It's an amazing book. You get the experience of this, of discovering all the different sentient races, the Hnau of Mars, the Hrasa, who are the poets, and the Sorns, who are the thinkers, and the Pfiffeldriggi, who are the technologists and architects. And you discover that there are these creatures called Eldil, which are spirits that you can kind of sort of almost see, but not quite. And there is a guardian spirit of the planet, the Oyarsa. Interestingly, this is Lewis taking the medieval cosmology that he writes about in The Discarded Image and placing it into the context of science fiction, which is generally, and especially in Lewis's day, dominated by people like H.G. Wells, coming from not a spiritual but a scientific materialist perspective. And that's precisely what he does in this chapter. So Ransom has been brought to the Oyarsa. Now Dr. Weston and Divine, who have been planning to conquer the planet and colonize the planet, so that human beings can then spread to it and then spread and become a multiplanetary species. Where have we heard that before recently? and are now brought before the Oyarsa. And this ends up being essentially a Platonic dialogue between the scientific materialism of Dr. Weston and the medieval cosmology as represented by the Oyarsa of Malacandra, the guardian spirit of Mars. And it's translated by Ransom. And this is important. This is a dialogue in translation because Ransom has to translate everything that Dr. Weston is saying in English into Malacandrian, which has no words for anything evil. So, I'll return to that. So here is the opening of Dr. Weston's speech. To you, I may seem a vulgar robber, But I bear on my shoulders the destiny of the human race. Your tribal life with its Stone Age weapons and beehive huts, its primitive coracles and elementary social structure has nothing to compare with our civilization, with our science, medicine, and laws, our armies, our architecture, our commerce, and our transport system, which is rapidly annihilating space and time. Our right to supersede you is the right of the higher over the lower. Life, half a moment, says Ransom in English. That's about as much as I can manage at one go. Then, turning to Ayarsa, he began translating as well as he could. The process was difficult, and the result, which he felt to be rather unsatisfactory, was something like this. Okay, keep in mind what Dr. Weston has just said. Among us, Ayarsa, there is a kind of Hnau, a sentient being, who will take other Hnau's food and things when they're not looking. He says he is not an ordinary one of that. To you, I may seem a vulgar robber. No, he's not an ordinary robber. He's just a robber. He says that what he does now will make very different things happen to those of our people who are not yet born. He has on his shoulders the destiny of the human race. He says that among you, Hnau of all one kindred live together, and the Harasa have spears like those we used a very long time ago, and your huts are small and round, and your boats are small and light like our old ones, and you have only one ruler. Your primitive society, right? He said it is different than us. With us, we know much. He says we know much. We have science. There's a thing that happens in our world when the body of a living creature feels pain and becomes weak. He says we sometimes know how to stop it. Our medicine. He says we have many bent people, and we kill them or shut them in huts, and that we have people for settling quarrels between the bent now about their huts and mates and things. We have laws. He says, we have many ways for the Hnau of one land to kill those of another, and some are trained to do it. We have military. He says, we build very big and strong huts of stone and other things, like the Piffletriggy. And he says, we exchange many things among ourselves and can carry heavy weights very quickly a long way. We have architecture and commerce. Because of all this, own transportation. Because of all this, he says, it would not be the act of a bent now if our people killed all your people. This is an absolutely brilliant rhetorical move. Lewis is taking this amazing rhetoric, which sounds very strong and powerful. It's like the ultimate rhetoric of the colonist. And he is completely deconstructing it and showing it to be the evil that it is. And he goes on. I'm going to have to skip ahead to the conclusion here. Weston says at the conclusion of his speech, I may fall, but while I live, I will not, with such a key in my hand, consent to close the gates of the future on my race. What lies in that future beyond our present ken passes imagination to conceive. Yet it is enough for me that there is a beyond. And he is saying, Ransom translated, that he will not stop trying to do all this unless you kill him. And he says that, although he doesn't know what will happen to the creature sprung from us, he wants it to happen very much. And what ensues then, so far we've had like the rhetoric of Weston in eloquent English, and now all of a sudden Lewis flips it. And there's an actual direct dialogue between Weston and the Ayarsa in broken Malacandrian. And Weston's Malacandrian, his Martian, is not very good. And the Ayarsa says to Weston, it is well that I have heard you. For though your mind is feebler, your will is less bent than I thought. It is not for yourself that you would do all this. There's a selfless element here. No, said Weston proudly in Malacandria. Me die, man live. Yet you know that these creatures would have to be made quite unlike you before they lived in other worlds. There'd need to be some sort of evolutionary process of adaptation to these other worlds. Yes, yes, all new. No one know yet. Strange, big. Then it is not the shape of the body that you love? No, no, me no care how they shaped. One would think then that it is for the mind you care, but that cannot be. Or you would love Hnau wherever you met it. You would love sentient beings wherever you met them. You would love the Martians as well, right? No care for Hnau, care for man. But if it is neither man's mind, which is as the mind of all other Hnau, is not Maladil, God, the maker of them all, nor his body, which will change, if you care for neither of these, what do you mean by man? This had to be translated to Weston. When he understood it, he replied, "Me care for man, care for our race, what man begets." He had to ask ransom for the words for race and beget. "Strange," said Ayarsa. "You do not love any one of your race. You would have let me kill ransom. You do not love the mind of your race, nor the body. Any kind of creature will please you, if only it is begotten of your kind, as they are now. It seems to me, thick one, that what you really love is no completed creature, but the very seed itself, for that is all that is left." "Tell him," said Weston, when he had been made to understand this, "that I don't pretend to be a metaphysician. I have not come here to chop logic. If he cannot understand, as apparently you can't either, at ransom, anything so fundamental as a man's loyalty to humanity, I can't make him understand it." But Ransom was unable to translate this, and the voice of Ayarsa continued, "I see now how the Lord of the Silent World has bent you. There are laws that all now know of pity and straight dealing and shame and the like, and one of these is the love of kindred. He has taught you to break all of them except this one, which is not one of the greatest laws. This one he has bent till it becomes folly, and has set it up thus bent to be a little blind Ayarsa, a little blind guardian spirit in your brain. And now you can do nothing but obey it, though if we ask you why it is a law, you can give no other reason for it than for all the other and greater laws which it drives you to disobey. Do you know why he has done this?"
"Me think no such person. Me wise new man. No believe all that old talk. Doesn't believe in the devil."
"I will tell you. He has left you this one because a bent now can do more evil than a broken one. He has only bent you, but this thin one, divine, who sits on the ground, he is broken, for he has left him nothing but greed. He is now only a talking animal. Tell me, thick one, why did you come here?
Me tell you, make man live all the time."
"But are your wise men so ignorant not to know that Malakandra is older than your own world and nearer its death?" The Mars is actually a dying world. "And soon now, very soon, I will end my world and give back my people to Maladil, to God.
Me know all that plenty. This only first try. Soon they go on to another world."
"But do you not know that all worlds will die?
Men go jump off, each before it ends. On and on, see?"
"And when all are dead?"
Weston was silent.
"How do you escape the heat death of the universe?" Right? I'll finish here with Weston's final words. I'm jumping again a bit, but he gets frustrated with this because he realizes it all is actually revealed here to be pointless. But there's a defiant tone here that he strikes at the very end. "Trash! Defeatist trash!" he shouts at the Ayarsa in English. And then drawing himself up to his full height, he adds in Malakandrian, "You say your Maladil let all go dead. Other one, bent one. He fight, jump, live, not all talky-talky. Me no care Maladil, like bent one better, me on his side." There's something brilliantly inspiring, and that's basically the end of the dialogue. There's something brilliantly inspiring about C.S. Lewis giving Weston the last defiant word in a way that actually does kind of resonate with us. In the same way that William Blake said that John Milton, who wrote Paradise Lost, was at the devil's party, but did not know it. Or that inspires us to prefer Dylan Thomas's "Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light," over John Donne's "As virtuous men pass mildly away." This gets at the heart of what language is, of what thinking is. Because as Plato said, there was a reason Plato wrote all his philosophy in dialogue. He felt that all dialogue, all philosophical communication had to be embodied, had to be something that was in a context of conversation. This then is ultimately why all of language is inherently intertextual. The point of language is dialogue. The interaction of my neural network's map of meaning with your neural network's maps of meaning, through the shared medium of language, to establish shared meaning, mutually held truths about the nature of the universe and of human experience, in the common understanding of the most basic unit of meaning, the word. Dialogue with the Word is ultimately then an act of love, which in the Christian tradition, as an echo of the Word, who is love, is about as biblically intertextual as you can get.